do we have the capacity to do the testing we need to do in order to reopen the economy, which everyone so badly wants?
Well, look, we've made a lot of progress in ramping up testing in this country after having a slow start. And so we're testing probably more than a million people a week right now. I think a good rule of thumb would be about 1% of the population on a weekly basis. So the ability to test about 3 million people. We're not going to be there. We're not going to be there in May. We're not going to be there in June. Hopefully, we'll be there by September. So the reality is, from a clinical standpoint, we're probably not going to have the optimal amount of testing, but we'll have better testing in place than we did.
That was former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on this morning's Today Show, talking about the politically controversial reopening of the economy, which he said we can begin to see roll out next month, despite the continued lack of adequate testing for both coronavirus and the antibodies that people have developed to fight off the dreaded plague. Hello, everyone. Happy Earth Day. Happy 420. Remember those? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by fellow pot-smoking environmentalists Nick Gillespie.
Hey, man. Oh, hey, man.
Jackson Brown joins us from remote. Peter Subin and Catherine Mankiw Ward. Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the apocalypse.
Howdy.
Let's first get caught up on the latest bullet points of dread. The death count in the U.S. is north of 42,000, with 750,000 people having been confirmed to be positive so far. That's a double the number of dead since last week. The rate of new cases, however, is slowing down. Worldwide, those numbers are around 170,000 deaths and 2.5 million confirmed cases. There were scattered and sparse protests that are kind of ongoing that happened over the weekend in about a half dozen states. Just got a disproportionate share of media coverage, perhaps because the president of the United States encouraged them. And people had funny signs and people made up funny signs that didn't exactly exist. For more, read reason.com. 22 million Americans, or around 13.5% of the labor force, are now unemployed or have filed for unemployment benefits. So maybe the actual number is higher. Congress and the Trump administration are nearing completion on yet another bailout package, this time around $470 billion. I think it's kajillion dollars now, what they've decided on to tack on the previous $2.3 trillion, and et cetera. You get the drift. Let's start off with the reopening, since that's what people seem to be talking about, and because that was the opening clip, which, frankly, we play Scott Gottlieb a lot here. Or I choose Scott Gottlieb because he talks so fast. You get a lot of information in that fast talking.
What's happening with vaping, though? You know, because he must be very upset that he can't talk about vaping.
I think he tries to shoehorn it in there in the 10th minutes of most interviews, but they cut him off at 8. Suderman, you cover health policy and Scott Gottlieb. You have a poster of Scott Gottlieb up in your basement bedroom.
It's actually a Scott Gottlieb Mr. Potato Head that could also be a Darth Vader Mr. Potato Head.
Scott Gottlieb. Chia pet?
We're not here to kink shame, Peter.
Mm. Look, there's a Dr. you can Potato see right behind head. Me. There's Dr. actually a Darth Vader Mr. Potato Head right now in view
I'm,
of you.
Deliberately not looking.
Yeah, you know, blur your background is the new delete
account. At any rate,
account.
Peter, give us your sense of the parameters as they exist right now in the reopening debates, both from a policy standpoint and a political standpoint. Where are we? How are people talking about it? What's your sense?
We are in a position of trying to figure out what position we're in. The Trump administration released some guidelines that were clear in certain ways, but also really quite vague. Last week, it was, you know, the Trump administration went sort of interesting, went from the beginning of the week to with Trump saying, you know, I have total authority to do anything. This is entirely up to me, to saying just a few days later, well, look, this is up to the governors. They are on their own. Here are some guidelines that we would like them to follow. The main thing about those guidelines is that they set up 2-week kind of milestones, check-ins. And so if you have drop-offs in new cases and in confirmed cases for 2 weeks, and you meet a couple of other criteria, then you should take step one and start reopening just a few things, which notably step one does not include schools, But you start opening a few things under somewhat restricted conditions. And then if things go well for another 2 weeks, you open up some more things. And then after 3 weeks, you open up some more things after that. And you just sort of kind of basically say at the, you know, after in stage three, you're, most things are open, although there are some suggestions that you should, you know, that maybe restaurants should keep tables further apart, things like that, that bars have to be open under limited conditions. And they still recommend that people, that everyone kind of take precautions, and that in particular, vulnerable people really try to take extra precautions and perhaps still basically act as if the economy is closed. And so that's the Trump administration's position is, I mean, here's some guidelines. Here's some markers that you should look at trying to hit. The thing is, the states are not really in a position to hit those markers because they rely on testing. And the testing, as we heard from Scott Gottlieb, just isn't there yet. We're doing a lot more testing than we used to. We're doing about 1 million tests a week. But Gottlieb is envisioning 3 or 4 million. There is a plan out from Harvard that that says we need 5 million tests per day. And we're just not there. We're not going to get there in the next couple of months. And so there is this now this sort of second order debate about what's going to happen when we reopen the economy. One risk of doing so, even if we do so in a slow and measured way and fairly, you know, and it's different in different states, is that there are second waves of infection. And it's really not clear to me what the public or political or policy world tolerance is going to be for second waves of infection. If you have one person who is infected, is that going to be enough to start shutting things down again? If you have 10 people who are infected, if you start to see a dozen deaths, if you see a cluster. And so I don't think people really know the answer to these questions. And so they've started to talk about, well, let's isolate and really focus our resources on the people who are the most vulnerable. But that just turns out to be much, much harder from a practical perspective than I think people are really thinking about. And so you have nursing homes, for example. Think about nursing homes, and they seem to be the most vulnerable places outside of the cruise ships that we have already closed down. If you want to isolate nursing homes, then you have to also isolate every single person who comes into or out of that nursing home, and you have to figure out ways to get all of those people. So all of those middle-aged, relatively healthy workers who may be going home to their kids, who may be going home to kids who eventually go to schools that reopen and that are passing around the thing. I'm definitely not saying, to be clear, that I don't want the economy to reopen, and I'm definitely not saying that we shouldn't try to figure out ways to do so as quickly as possible. But the state that we are in right now is that we have some guidelines about what it might take to reopen. And we have some hopeful thoughts about some strategies that we might employ. But the actual granular details of how this is all going to work out and what the political, social health tolerances are going to be for failures, or at least for kind of cracks in the system, it's really not clear to me. I don't think it's clear to a lot of policymakers, to governors and people working in governors' offices. And the Trump administration has basically said, you know what, governors, you guys are going to figure it out on your own. In theory, they'll support you, or perhaps President Trump will spend his Friday tweeting about how protesters should, in fact, liberate Minnesota and Michigan and Virginia.
Well, first of all, it's about time that Minnesota got liberated. But Nick, I heard you groaning in your Fire Fauci T-shirt over there.
Now Fauci is, he's bringing real disrepute on Italian Americans, Matt, and we don't have that many points to give at this point. Having said all of that, I think what we're starting to approach is also an understanding that the rates of hospitalization and the rates of death or, you know, fatality are very much sequestered in older Americans, and that there is we're not going to have the testing. Peter is absolutely right. We're not going to have the testing for any foreseeable time, you know, where we'll be able to open things up based on people passing tests. It's going to be more flying blind. And I think we're starting to begin the discussion of what portion of mostly older people are going to be hospitalized and a certain number are going to die. And that is the price of reopening the economy. And it's going to be ugly. I think it's actually going to be, the conversation is going to be ugly. I think the mechanics of it will be easier than we think. But to layer on to Peter's concerns is what happens when you open stuff up and people still don't come out? Because this is, you know, there is a kill switch to kill the economy. Like you can pretty much throw a lever and shut everything down. And we did that about a month ago, you know, writ large over the U.S. Opening it back up, you know, isn't quite as easy. And that's, you know, when you look at surveys, and these things will change rapidly as well, but people talking, you know, it's going to be 30, 60, 90 days before I feel comfortable going to a theater, going to a restaurant, doing this or doing that, you know, declaring the lockdown over is the very beginning of a very long process that is going to be, you know, pretty mystical and mystifying and enraging, I think, for all of us.
Catherine, I saw a bar graph on the internet, so it must be true, but showing the different sickness and death rates among age cohorts by decades, 0 to 10, 11 to 20, and so on. And I'm sure we've all seen variants of that. And basically, until you get to be Matt Welch age, with a couple of notable exceptions, younger, it's the percentages are just not bad at all. And afterwards, and especially with pre-existing morbidities, one of the many words that I hope to forget in 30 to 60 to 90 days is comorbidity, and along with PPE. But so what's the argument, Catherine, against saying, okay, you youngs on this call, go out and herd immunity all over yourselves. That's going to be fine. And keep the olds on this phone call, me and Nick, isolated. What's wrong with just doing that?
I mean, that is an option we're going to have to seriously consider, because as we just talked about for the first bit of this podcast, we're not going to be able to execute some of the other proposed, more sensible alternatives, like, for instance, testing everyone. So, yeah, but I mean, that world is a deeply weird world, and it's a world that has its own batch of very dire implications for civil liberties. And that's a thing that I've just been thinking about somewhat obsessively and maybe even unhelpfully at this point, because it is all, for the most part, speculative. But, you know, when does the pressure to reopen not just economic life, but also social life? I mean, people want people.
Even you?
When does that? But when does that pressure build up in a way that we start making compromises? And I just saw a photo this morning.
Compromises with civil liberties.
With civil liberties. Yeah. And you know, we have talked a lot at Reason for the last 50 years and on this podcast about how there is already incredibly uneven enforcement when you create an overbroad authorization for law enforcement to act, like in stop and frisk, for instance. Typically, those problems have been related to race. But what happens when old people are the targeted category? Like, that's
Logan's
a very
run.
Weird.
It's Logan's Run.
Oh, my God. Nick, you've been living, your whole life has been leading up to the moment when we, as a society, aggressively Logan's Run style, discriminate against, hunt down and exile old people.
But like a classic tragedy, it only kicks in when he's an old person.
Yeah, well, that's
that,
story
by
checks
that,
out.
You mean turning 30.
Yes, right. Okay. Matt, I also want to note that a thing that exists that has always made me laugh in like the darkest possible way is there's a publication called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. And it's a thing that, like, the CDC actually uses. It's been around since, like, I don't know, the 20s or the 30s or something. And
at least it's not called a survival report. That's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, I guess that's, well, it depends on which one. At some point, one may become more efficient than the other, right? Yeah. Maybe it's easier to just list who's living.
I think, though, that, you know, the civil liberties issues are pressing, especially because a lot of the kind of reopening things will say something like you can only fly or take Amtrak. And this is actually one proposal that's out there. You'll only be able to take that if you present evidence of a negative COVID-19 test or something. You know, that opens up a lot of civil liberty stuff, which is dicey. The age thing, if it's not mandatory, if we're not saying, okay, if you look over 50, you know, you've got to be carded if somebody sees you on the street, but rather, you know, that the broad guidelines are that we're going to open stuff up. You are kind of an idiot if you have an underlying condition and you're, you know, 50 or older, much less 80 or older, and go strolling around to nightclubs or something. But I think that is not necessarily, it will have massive cultural shifts and possibly political shifts, but I don't think it will necessarily have civil liberties implications, unless the mandate is like, if you're above a certain age, you're not supposed to be seen.
I don't know of any widespread, broad kind of lockdown parameters, or, you know, government telling people what they can and can't do, which we see all over the country now, literally all over the country, that do not have implications for civil liberties. That's what I mean. They're telling you, you are not free to do X, Y, Z, and then AA, and then BB, and CC. So, like, I can't see how this doesn't end up being an infringement. I just think that we are in such a cramped space, with like trillions flapping over our brains and all kinds of insane, like, essential, inessential distinctions, and people, you know, the mayor of this city, I struggled not to cuss there. The mayor of the city that I'm listening, podcasting here from, you know, saying, if you have if you see someone not social distancing enough, you can call me, just 311 me. I mean, it's going to be, it already is a massive impact on civil liberties. It's just that we're in the clench right now, and we're not.
But
sort of,
wait, I mean, like, there, it. You know, there are times where certain. The problem isn't that civil liberties get curtailed during an emergency, right? For a short, delimited period of time where there is an absolute beginning and an absolute end. It's when they slog over. But if we get to a point...
I mean, sometimes that is a problem too, but I will grant this as a rhetorical move that you're making.
Yeah,
right
now. No, and I mean, what I'm trying to think about is, like, you know, there's something truly screwed up when the government is saying this is an essential business and this is a non-essential one, you know, and then there's all the variations on that are, if you're Home Depot, we're going to close off certain aisles because they're not essential to your business plan. But if you're a small store in Michigan, you can sell paint and seeds, you know, et cetera. That's all of that is a given. What I'm saying is that if we have something, I can see an opening, a reopening plan that is more along a Swedish model, where they're not actually shutting down things as much as there might be some minor, or not minor, but there are some limits on the number of people in a gathering and all of that kind of stuff. But it's basically, they're saying, here's the information, you should quarantine if you're at higher risk or not. And there's...
I think the concern with some of that is that we end up with that sort of plan ends up going along with tracking systems, and tracking systems that are designed theoretically to anonymize the data and to not make it possible for, even if someone were to kind of hack the information, to find out anything specific about you, Nick Gillespie, or you, Matt Welch, Catherine, they would find out stuff about you. But
ideally, it would be a scanner darkly,
right?
Where we would be reporting on ourselves without realizing.
I was having a conversation about a study out of China that looked at a super spreading event in a restaurant, and that sort of was looking at the way that spreading can be aerosolized, right? So it's not just that it kind of goes from person to person in close proximity, but that it stays in the air, is passed around. In this case, it appeared to have been passed around. They traced it so that they could see who got it based on the path of the air conditioning vent. And some people got it 30 minutes after the original person came into the restaurant and left. And so it was still hanging around in the air, sort of moving from table to table. And it's a fascinating study in terms of what it tells us about how the virus spreads. But what's really terrifying about it is that the Chinese researchers clearly had, down to the foot and table, perfect data about every single person in that restaurant and their movements. And they probably had it from some combination of cell phone tracking and surveillance video. And they were able to get that. And so in some ways, that's useful to have, right? If you are researching the spread of a virus that spreads very quickly between people and you're trying to figure out exactly how transmission works. On the other hand, that sort of technology lingers. It hangs in the air for a long time. It becomes aerosolized, right? And then we all catch it, right? You know, and it's hard to tell exactly how it's going to linger and what is going to be used with it. But I would venture to say that as soon as the government gets involved in that sort of process, in that sort of at least tracking, if not active management, of where you go, who you meet with, what you do with your time, that does not lead to good things.
What I'm hearing here is air conditioning is bad.
Those of us who remember Legionnaire's disease already knew that.
Tell it to the tens of thousands of Europeans who die in every heat wave out there.
Yeah.
Air conditioning is only bad when there are other people involved. So we all need our own personal air conditioning units.
You know, by the same token, we started off by talking about how there isn't going to be tracking and tracing available in the United States for a variety of reasons.
I think certainly if we end up going a year or two without a vaccine or worse, without pretty effective antiviral treatments, that sort of thing will be developed. And there will certainly be a push. I'm not going to say that it will pass, but there will be a push for some sort of federal involvement in a tracking and tracing process.
I agree. I was going to say that, you know, in the short term, there's a technological issue and just a kind of operational one. Are there enough tests? How do you do it? How do you collate the centralize the data and all of that kind of stuff? Then how do you get people not only to be using, an app on their cell phones, but actually turning Bluetooth on and all of that kind of stuff? In the longer term, there are these issues. There is a political and cultural pushback in the United States, which is currently being made fun of by, you know, the legacy media, which now includes cable and post-cable sources like Vox, of protesters. But that's a healthy pushback as well, that there is a culture where the United States, you know, people in the United States do not want to be tracked and traced. You know, to that level of degree, we do certain types of limited contact tracing, certain types of STDs. If you present with a problem, and I'm speaking here mostly from Matt's experience of this, when you go to a hospital room or, you know, the neighbor who sometimes takes people down into the basement and does a gynecological or genital examination, you get entered into a database and they do contact tracing. So I'm confident that we will have to reopen before the technology and the testing apparatus is in place, and that will help work as a bulwark against, you know, the Trump or the Biden administration in 2021 coming in and saying, you know what, we got to start tracking and tracing people for a pandemic which has peaked and passed and is kind of in the backward mirror.
Catherine, to move the conversation away from basement gynecological exams.
Love to do that. Thank you.
Sure. So Congress is back in session thinking about sending another.
I thought you were getting it away from genitals, Matt, talking about Congress.
Sending another $500 billion out the window. Did we just spend $2.3 trillion and no one noticed?
Yes.
Is that what's happening here? And then if that's the case, what's the final price tag on this going to be? Is it going to be $10 trillion? Does money even exist anymore? It's 420.
Yeah. I mean, this is a remarkable thing about the way the conversation is going right now, is that we truly did spend over $2 trillion, and the immediate response, you know, no pause for breath, was it wasn't enough. We have to spend more. And there's no reason to think that's not going to happen at least a couple more times, maybe several more times, because there's always something else that needs fixing. Once you grant the premise, I mean, this is the old, you know, we've already established what you are, madam. We're just negotiating the price. Like, we've now established the premise that if anybody is hurting from coronavirus at any level of society, we should probably at least talk about and probably do a massive bailout of that thing. And, you know, one problem is that it's taking a long time to get the individual bailout or the individual stimulus checks into people's accounts. I got an email saying sometime between now and July, you may or may not get a deposit in your account. I think a lot of people are getting emails like that. So on the very, very kind of micro individual level, there's still just massive amounts of uncertainty about where that money is or if anyone will ever see it in action. The same thing is happening with the small business loans. And, you know, I think big corporations that have lawyers and pre-negotiated exactly the terms of their bailout are using that money more effectively, but still have no reason to say, nope, that's enough, we're good. I did see this morning that Shake Shack has declined its
$10 million. $10 million. Yeah,
it makes me want to go get a burger just to kind of high five those dudes. Although, also, let's be clear, probably their accountants just did some kind of math and realized that they could benefit from some other program more or something like that. But yeah, so I think the fact that we have just absolutely gone right back to the drawing board and have a willingness to spend another trillion or 2 trillion or 3 trillion, and there's no end in sight, is it's really disheartening. It's really frightening in the long term. And I don't see where the bright line is that we can buy at this point, or that we can choose at this point.
Can I ask people, in terms of a kind of government response, a federal response economically to this, would you prefer that all of the money that is being used to kind of float the economy go directly to individuals, which is something Justin Amash has talked about, or that there shouldn't be as, like, there should only be a fraction of as much money going out, or it should only be designated for stuff like healthcare and food to get? And I'm not exactly sure where I am on this. I mean, the $2.2 trillion is insane. And the idea that airlines and, you know, various things, even cruise ship companies were asking for a handout, that's all insanity. But then when you start to bring it down to more manageable levels, like, what is the legitimate role of the federal government in this? I mean, I would tend to think it's, you know, yeah, you don't want people to starve and you want them to have some kind of health care. But other than that, I'm not sure what else we should be expecting.
I mean, this is something that we talked about, you know, a couple weeks back and a couple weeks before that as well. I think this is something that my thinking really hasn't evolved on, even though a lot has happened on the ground. My impulse remains, if we are going to do anything, it should be as local and small as possible. To me, that means direct to individuals in nearly every case. But I think Peter is going to chime in here and say, but there is still this, to my mind, also a very legitimate question of, when the shutdowns are imposed by the state, does the state owe restitution in some form? Like, that's a legitimate kind of moral and ethical question to ask in this context. At the same time, I think as a pragmatic matter, as a practical matter, that money is, if not quite being lit on fire, certainly not being used in a maximally efficient way.
There is no limiting principle, Peter. That's my problem with your position, besides the fact that you were playing the worst music I've ever heard in my life before we started this podcast. Mm.
It was the Beach Boys? Peter, I didn't know you were a Beach Boys fan.
Yeah.
Shots fired.
Is that, yes, you can make a very coherent intellectual argument for the government did this and forced people to shut down. But I saw a headline in the Wall Street Journal, I think this morning, or at least over the weekend, saying that lockdowns, not the actual like capacity on hospitals, but the lockdowns have caused or sending hospitals into bankruptcy. And so they're looking for bailouts from the federal government because they're going bankrupt because the other patients aren't coming in and using their service. It's just like, okay, that's it. We're just on a Mobius strip of trillions of dollars right now. What is the limiting principle behind pseudonomics?
Well, there's never a limiting principle when Congress is involved. And when Congress is inherently involved in federal policymaking, and they get to decide whatever the limits are, and their limit is whatever I feel like this afternoon, and if I change my mind, then I change my mind. And so there's plenty of ways that you can put a limiting principle in place. You can say, for example, that our total bailout fund is limited to X number of dollars, and that is all we're going to do. And then what we're going to do is we're going to set a number of dollars, and then we're going to prioritize out of that. You can say that we will only pay restitution, if that's what you're going to call it, for certain types. You can create categories, right? And so then there's of people who have been harmed by this. So perhaps we would pay for for hospitals, for example, but not for, say, airlines, because airlines are a different category. You can put those limiting principles in place, but in the end, it kind of just doesn't matter, as we have seen already with $2.2 trillion as a starting bid on a recovery and aid bill here. And we're going to see, I think, certainly we're going to see another $500 billion passed, but I think it's quite likely that we end up seeing a couple trillion more passed. And so my problem with all of this isn't necessarily that the federal government is getting involved in spending a bunch of money in a time of crisis. It is that they are definitely going to do it in a bad way. They're going to do it in a way that is erratic and difficult for people to access the funds they need. The money is not going to go to people who need it in a lot of cases, because there's going to be a lot of argument about where this money, about how the money gets spent, how it gets dispersed. There's just going to be kind of implementation problems. I mean, we've already seen a ton of this with the small business program, where the Small Business Administration, which is historically just a disaster of an agency, is now in charge of dispersing so far $350 billion worth of loans. And it looks like they're going to add about another $300 billion, and I wouldn't be surprised if they end up adding a couple more $100 billion after that.
So what should be done?
So I think the plan that I am most interested in, though I wouldn't quite go so far as to say this is definitely what we should do. This is not an endorsement. This is I'm floating a thing.
Just a retweet.
That's it, right? This is I'm floating a thing that I think makes some sense. And instead of giving a flat amount of money or a scaled amount of money to every individual, what we did was we put the economy in a coma. So what we should do with fiscal policy is to try and keep it on life support as best as possible. And I think the best way to do that is probably to target the class of business and the class of worker that has been hurt the most, and to say that for small businesses and medium-sized businesses that keep people on payroll but can't function sort of at normal levels, the government is going to pay a certain percentage of that payroll. And so what it does is it keeps people attached to the labor force, right? It keeps sort of it hits the pause button. It says, here's the economy as it was March 9th, or whatever the last day of semi-normalcy was. We want, when all of this is over, to come back to that economy. And so what we don't want to do is have firms laying off workers and have workers have incentives, as we now have with the expanded UI benefits, to not come back to work. What we want to do is have everyone have an incentive to first stay home when you need to, and second, stay attached to the job that you had. And that seems to me like a very expensive plan that at least has some sort of principle to it. That's roughly what they're doing in the United Kingdom and what they're doing in Denmark. And in Europe in general, they have not seen quite the level. It's the economy there is very bad, to be clear, but they have not seen quite the level of job loss and economic dislocation that we have in the United States, because we may end up doing that as a second or third or fourth round plan after we've already blown through a couple of $1 trillion on bad small business programs. And I just, you know, there's a little bit of that in the bill. It's being administered badly. People can't get the funds. It's not necessarily going to places that deserve it or that should have it. But as a basic idea about how to respond to this, put the economy in pause and make it so that when you press the play button, the laser is still, you know, at the right point in the CD. The tracking needle is still hovering above the vinyl in the right
man,
part.
Man, we're streaming. Your allegories,
yes,
and metaphors are outdated.
We have an analog economy, and we should treat it as
ooh,
such.
Yeah. Now, wow. Maybe we should let it die and be reborn as
Peter,
Spotify.
Peter came correct to this podcast with two full-fledged tidy metaphors already. Like, Matt, what, he's challenging you. What are you gonna do?
I don't even understand what language
you
is
know what a record
here,
player
so
is.
Is it Friday? What day is today?
Yeah, it's Friday.
420 again.
Yeah, it's 420. Every day is 420.
Nick name checked Justin Amash earlier. So let's do a pivot to exciting Libertarian Party politics.
The interloper potential. Justin Amash.
The interloper, Justin Amash. So I failed in my prognostication. Mm-hmm. I had a theory that he would declare his presidential candidacy one way or the other, the decision, the LeBron James-style decision on April 18th, which was Saturday, because that was his 40th birthday. And he's just that kind of nerd who, you know, he declared his independence for the Republican Party on July 4th, man. But he didn't do that. So much for that. But he's still the congressman, the independent congressman who self-describes to Reason and other people as libertarian, not even libertarian conservative. He drew attention to himself last week by saying, I'm over here thinking about running for president. look at me thinking about it. So I wanted to get a sense from the room. We've talked about this previously in different kind of trial balloon moments. Should just quickly point out that there's been one poll since this new floating from a Morning Consult that had him at all of 1% nationally and having no impact on the spread between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And then also since that news broke, there's the first quarter fundraising results from his congressional race in Michigan in the 3rd District, in which, because he said that he had stopped basically fundraising as of mid-February. So his competitors are on the Democratic and Republican side are outraising him a little bit this quarter. Overall, he's got as much or more money in the bank. That's the background. Catherine, you're the one who got him to talk about this on stage about 15 months ago. Where are you in the run, Justin, run camp right now?
I'm torn because I would very much like to have someone in the race who didn't completely suck. Just like anyone in the race who didn't super, super suck. And right now I'm not seeing that. At the same time, the waffling is getting to me. I mean, as you just noted, I was like, ha ha, there's been a lot of speculation. Maybe you might run on the Libertarian ticket. What do you think, my guy? Like, by my calculations, it wasn't 15 months ago. It was 3 centuries ago. And it's not yes. Justin Amash's
like,
fault.
Before
that
people
time...
even said my guy, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's not Justin Amash's fault that time has ceased to have meaning. Like, I'm not going to pin that one on him. But
yet,
it's been a hot minute. And I understand there are strategic reasons to pause and also that he might genuinely just not be decided. I mean, it's a weird and difficult decision to run for an office that you definitely won't win and to put your heart and soul into that for many, many, many months. And so I get it that he might be like looking at his 40th birthday and looking at this opportunity and be like, I just can't quite. But I'm kind of done with the waffle. And I think that it's possible that that the fact that he has been kind of teasing this decision for so long reduced the quality of the pool otherwise in the LP. And I don't really know how to speak to that. Matt, you probably could give a more informed take on it. But if I were a sort of middle of the road, decent LP candidate, thinking about the possibility that I might put a year's worth of effort in and then just get upstaged by Justin Amash, I might also step out this year. So I do think there are some second order effects to the waffling that are probably not good for the voices of libertarians in electoral politics.
Just to address that, I don't think that had an impact, Catherine.
You're saying that the prospective LP presidential candidates didn't take political realities into account when deciding whether or not to mount a maximal challenge or
be
not?
Be nice. I was trying to say it nicely.
Please don't put words in my mouth. Although I will put words in Catherine's mouth that pause after he definitely won't win was a throwback to the Ron Paul days of yore from your point of view, Catherine.
That pause was Amash himself has said to me, I would only run in any race if I really believe I could win. Like we have had that conversation and I...
And then you have your answer.
I think that's the right approach, but I also think that there's a very, very powerful force in politics, which is that you kind of have to believe you might reach your stretch goal. Like you have to, if everyone was just super, super hard-headed and pragmatic, they wouldn't run for office because it's often a long shot and things change. So I don't quite know how to understand that because I cannot see inside his head, but he has definitely said, I'm not going to run unless I think I can win. And I just don't, like, a Libertarian Party candidate isn't going to win the 2020 election. I'm sorry.
There isn't, to my knowledge, what you would describe as some kind of like deep bench of candidates, like one of the favorite people within the party who's considered to be, you know, he cleans up nice for the outsiders, who is now running for vice president along the sort of a ticket with Judge Jim Gray, who also declared about 10 days ago, is Larry Sharp. Larry Sharp came in 4th place in for the governor's race in New York got like 1.2% of the vote in a state where like Andrew Cuomo was going to win by gigantic amounts. And he raised a ton of money. Like he was, it was a historic run, got the party ballot access and all that kind of stuff. But let's not kid ourselves about the attraction of anybody. And this is like, that's high grade kind of political things. Nick, you're chortling over there wearing your MAGA hat.
I am chortling, yeah. Now that Elizabeth Warren is out, I mean, who's going to take over the libertarian lane in the presidential race, right? Liberty abhors a vacuum, Matt. No, I think the point of an Amash run for me it has less to do about the LP or even third party candidates. Given his age, he's a millennial or close enough. He and his God, whole governing
ethos.
Darn it,
Nick, stop doing that.
Why? What?
He's not a millennial, just like I'm not a millennial, just like whatever.
Oh, okay.
You don't even know we're having this fight is the most frustrating part of it.
No, I know, but as an elder, I'm just ignoring it. But sort that trash on your own time, sister. Okay?
Wow.
About generational things. What I'm saying, as a 40-year-old, he represents the next generation of of leaders in a race that is so old. It is like unbelievably old. It's like between Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
If we have to isolate the vulnerable people, does that mean that Joe Biden and Donald Trump can't run for president?
Think of the sneeze guards they're going to have if they have presidential debates. They're each going to be in like a cone of silence or something like that. Space helmets.
They'll do the debate on Zoom or on FaceTime, but they won't be able to frame their shot because old people can't frame their Zoom and FaceTime shots. So it'll be Joe Biden's forehead and Donald Trump's like chin. And that's all.
I got Joe Biden in the betting markets to do the boy in the bubble clap push-ups.
Okay, we would love that. But Amash represents not only like he would look different. He is the next wave of American leaders, regardless of ideology. I mean, he has more in common with somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. There's an immigration story. There is a different story than is being told by traditional politicians. His politics are, which I tend to agree with almost 100%, with the exception of abortion rights. He is anti-abortion, and I think that's a problem for a lot of reasons from a libertarian perspective. But be that as it may, he represents a decentralist impulse, which I think is going to define the 21st century, or that's the battleground. And I want to see him in this race, not because he can win or it's good for him down the road or whatever. It's that he can inject a needed virus of a decentralization of a forward-looking set of ideas into American politics. And I think the fact that he, has immigrant roots, that he has an alternative religion because he's an Orthodox Christian, that he's from Michigan but represents something very different than the plodding old Mitt Romney, George Romney past of Detroit and things like that. That's why I want to see him in this, because he'll be the first president who actually, knows who knows who Salma Hayek is, who knows who Friedrich Hayek is. And that would be good for everybody.
I think Joe Biden knows who Salma Hayek is. Peter, you know what I'm talking about? Biden and Trump, if I have the math correct, and I must because I said this confidently in print, but are both the oldest person to ever run for president or be the major nominees of a major party. Peter, what say you about Salma Hayek's friend?
Justin Amash is, to be clear, not a millennial. He's a Xennial with a capital X. That makes him like Catherine and like me, generation-wise. We are a special generation because we're the in-between.
You are very special.
We're very special. We're the in-between generation. Yeah. We're the last generation of people who knew what it was like to not have the internet.
Last generation.
And also the people who got the internet.
I remember what it was like. Please, this is what a sad thing that you're going to pin everything to. We're the last people who remember dial rotary phones, and you don't even. You remember touchstone phones. It's no different than hitting a cell phone.
Justin Amash played Oregon Trail in elementary school, and I think he'd make a good president. But, in the I mean, he's not going to be president, but I think he'd make a good one. I would like to see him run if he could do it in a way that would, I mean, not just, so he's not going to win, but I think you can imagine a scenario in which he runs in a way that really elevates the ideas. And he is actually, he's a good speaker and a good thinker, even, and that's maybe not true of the major party candidates right now. And, you know, it's so nice to like see his Twitter feed, which he clearly writes himself, and just to see stuff that's like, oh, this could be the nut graph in a Reason piece all the time. No, the president doesn't get magical, quote, total authority power by declaring an emergency. Make federalism a thing again. Contrary to what President Trump apparently thinks, the president doesn't authorize individual governors of individual states to do their jobs. They don't work for him. I mean, he does these sort of, you know, pointed constitutional explainers that are actually useful, and also tweets on April 14th, it's snowing, smiley face. I love it. I'm a fan.
I want a presidential candidate who has most of his own teeth, or her own teeth, their own teeth.
That's
said this, let's not leave the LP behind. This is also a critical moment, I think, for the LP. They're coming off the two best general election results that they ever had in the presidential race. And are they going, are the people like the diehards who are there, you know, and the Bumper Hornbergers, the Adam Kokeshes of the world and stuff, are they going to do stuff, regardless of what Amash does, to really expand the reach and influence and kind of persuasive power of libertarian ideas? I think that's an open question. And of course, they're hamstrung even more than usual, as is any other third party this time, because you can't really campaign the way that you might have. And we don't know what that's going to look like over the next
six
months.
I actually wonder if this presents an opportunity for someone like Amash. There are certainly ballot access issues for third parties that are more difficult than usual, and they are already difficult. On the other hand, if you assume that large campaign rally style gatherings are not going to be a thing in the 2020 election, if you assume that the bulk of the campaigning is going to be done online, doesn't that sort of flatten the doesn't that flatten the curve, right? Doesn't that sort of
curve,
doesn't that condense the space in which campaigns are run and make it at least plausible that a third party candidate could stand out in a way that is unusual, because it kind of puts everybody on the same footing, right? You're all broadcasting from a Bluetooth microphone, sitting at your, not from a Bluetooth mic, but like from a, you know, a Blue Yeti, whatever, like sitting at your desk somewhere, you know, hopefully you've bought like a ring light from Amazon that was meant for Instagram stars. And that's what you can do, and that's how campaigning is going to work. And in a way,
I wonder if that actually
creates an opportunity space for a third party candidate to get a message out, not necessarily to win.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think that, but I think it mostly locks in the name recognition of Trump and Biden in a big way.
And what is the lesson of the online world for the last 15 years is that on the one hand, name recognition is huge. On the other hand, when you create mass platforms and you give people, you know, sort of equal opportunity to have a stage and have a platform, some people can break out. And I'm not saying Amash would necessarily be that person. I'm saying it seems a little more plausible.
PewDiePie 2020.
In some ways.
You got to play the long game. You got to play the long game of ideas, not of personalities. It's not going to be Amash now or in 2024 or in 20 whatever. But the ideas get out there. Peter, I think of, you know, online as a supplemental space. And so you have YouTube stars, and, you know, and later Instagram stars and stuff like that, who are far bigger than any legacy media late night people. PewDiePie is a bigger star than Jimmy Fallon, but you still have all of the old late night shows that are huffing fumes from Johnny Carson's, you know, exhausted tank decades ago. What is good, I think, is that we can start building that supplemental space that might become the main place that we live in, which is a set of ideas in government that is distinct from what we're, you know, what is going down the drain now. Because we should also be trying to figure out how disastrous we, you know, not simply to the economy or politics as usual, but how disastrous to the main parties is the response to the coronavirus and the pandemic and stuff like that. They are wasting so much money. They're, you know, the Democrats and Republicans are going to take the blame for fucking everything up. And it is on them. So
Justin Amash can be president of Second Life.
Yeah.
To quickly address one thing that Nick said about the current crop of candidates, which is being led by Jacob Hornberger and, you know, arguably Vermin Supreme, who's won a couple of primaries, non-binding primaries. Adam Kokesh is in the mix. Up until now, it has been, up until a couple of weeks ago, it has largely been a competition over who's going to go for the libertarian wing of the Libertarian Party, with a sense internally of, like, we've had more squishy kind of...
So a duel, a Burr-Hamilton-style duel with fully automatic weapons.
Well, I mean, Hornberger's gone to the front of that line, but the entrance of Judge Jim Gray in the wake of Lincoln Chafee not catching fire is an appeal to the... we need a broader message and something that can appeal to outsiders. We'll see how popular that is internally in the party. Who knows? Let's get to our end of podcast. What the hell have you been consuming stuff? Nick, do you want to go first?
Sure. Today, of course, is 420, a big pot day. But yesterday was April 19th, which is known in psychedelic circles as Bicycle Day, because on April 19th, 1943, Albert Hofmann, the guy who synthesized LSD, famously took a bike ride and the first kind of planned dose of LSD. And I've been reading, partly in anticipation of that, but I was reading LSD, My Problem Child, a kind of fantastic memoir by Hofmann about LSD and psychedelics more broadly and what they meant in their first decade, second decade, etc. You can buy the book at Amazon. MAPS, the group led by Rick Doblin, published an expanded edition of the book a while ago. It's, if you're interested in a kind of counter history of the 20th century, Hofmann is a really fascinating character, because as all of this other stuff was going on about the Cold War, and whatnot, he helped create mind-blowing drugs that ended up having a massive cultural effect, there's still a very small minority of people have ever taken them, but they've had a huge effect. And his take on people like Timothy Leary and the counterculture is kind of fascinating and more or less exactly what you would expect from a Swiss chemist.
Catherine, what kind of drugs you've been taking?
Not as good a ones as Nick, as usual. But I actually finally finished a book that I had started quite a long time ago, Children of Blood and Bone, which is by Tomi...
Laren?
No. Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi. It's really good. It's a very compelling novel. Pretty difficult to read, which is one reason that I started it as beach reading long, long ago, when people could go to beaches in places other than, I guess, Florida, where everyone is at the beach inappropriately socially distanced or whatever the internet is mad about right now.
A bunch of the beaches in Florida are closed by order of the county.
Right.
Or so I am told by my Floridian parents.
Yeah, your Floridian inside sources inform you.
Yeah.
It's very good. It has a kind of magical fantasy overlay. It's set in West Africa, or sort of a fantasy version of West Africa. And I recommend it on the level of escapism. I do want to return to my recommendation last week, which was Station 11, and was about a plague wiping out nearly all of humanity, and what the world looks like before that plague, during it, and then 20 years after it. Wow, did that book give me nightmares, you guys. I still recommend it because it was really very good and on point, but also it actually disrupted my sleep. So just, you choose whether you want to go all in on the absolute worst case scenario for a global pandemic, or whether you want to go just to a whole... other place, different place than the one we live in.
I will have a comment about that notion when I go, which I'm not going to next, but I did want to interject before Suderman just to say something that I forgot to say earlier about the effect of the coronavirus on libertarian and third parties. As mentioned in Elizabeth Nolan Brown's Morning Links this morning, on Monday. Really awful for third-party candidates to get on the ballot. They can't collect signatures because it's hard to get a signature socially distanced. So there's going to be a lot of legal fights as to that. And it, I think, will almost definitely lead to the Libertarian Party not getting on all 50 ballots like it did the previous two effectively. Go, Peter, what have you been consuming?
I finished watching the 8-episode miniseries Devs, which is produced by FX but airing on Hulu. It was entirely written and directed by a single guy, Alex Garland, who you may know from being the writer and director of Annihilation and Ex Machina. He also is the writer of the novel that the movie The Beach was based on, the writer of 28 Days Later and Sunshine, has done a bunch of collaborations with Alex, with Danny Boyle, excuse me. But now he's writing and directing his own stuff. This miniseries is one of the very best shows I have seen on television in a really long time. It is the first series I can remember certainly in months and maybe in years where I was just like kind of like sitting on the edge of my seat waiting to see each new episode, right? Like I felt a palpable excitement to see what was going to come next. It is philosophical and beautiful and just an incredibly intelligent but also humane. It is a show set in modern present-day San Francisco, but it's a science fiction series that takes on a problem that I have been kind of obsessed with since I was fairly young, which is the problem of God's foreknowledge and free will. Basically, so the series is inspired by the question of, if God knows everything, including the future, how do you actually have free will? And so it's not a religious show overtly, but what it does is it takes you into a tech company where a tech billionaire played by Nick Offerman, who's so good in this, is working on developing a computer that models everything. And it is built on the idea of determinism. And what you eventually find out is that he suffered a trauma in which he is worried that he may have played a role in a car accident that killed his wife and daughter. And so he's completely obsessed with in some ways proving that he didn't have a choice, that there was no way that he could have done otherwise, that this was just sort of determined to happen. And so it's in the same way that 28 Days Later and The Beach and Annihilation are about worlds in which the old rules have been suspended, in which social expectations and norms are no longer exist in the way that we are used to them. And then the question of how does one maintain morality in those worlds? This is about the question of how one maintains moral values and sort of a moral sensibility in a world in which you believe that all choices are preordained. And so it is a really powerful kind of brief for the value and necessity of choice, both for individuals and for society. It goes really interesting places. It's incredibly well plotted. And finally, since I've been tweeting about it and since it has also made me extremely happy over the last couple of days, I will just recommend that anyone who has ever liked modern pop music at all should listen to the new Fiona Apple record, Fetch the Bolt Cutters. It's her first in 8 years. She recorded it in her Venice Beach house over the last several years, where she basically didn't leave for several years. She went on walks on the beach and recorded music and kind of went nuts, on the album. And it is this absolutely magical and delightful portrait of someone who has been locked inside and locked inside themselves. And it's just the thing that you want to listen, that you want to listen to right now.
The internal mind of a rock star. Yeah, no, haven't
thought
about
that.
It's
so good.
Before.
At the end of the third, so the title track, she recorded it at home and she was like learning how to do all this. A bunch of the tracks are done just straight through live, and her dogs start barking because she'd forgotten to close the door in her studio. And so the dogs end up providing this kind of this environmental percussion as she's finishing out this absolutely incredible song. It's just an amazing, amazing piece of music, and I am completely obsessed with it.
Back in the 60s, every band had a party record that had like dogs barking and people clapping and chatter, and it was all total BS. It was all
vegetables
piped in afterwards.
Though, to be fair, this is like the opposite of that, right? Yeah. This is, it's the...
Yeah, this is not a party record.
Social distancing
this
record.
Is the landscape of
this
the rock star.
This is a self-isolation
And I realize
record.
This isn't
At
quite that.
Rate.
Yeah. You know, Matt, are you a Mr. Soul fan? Like, what's the first song by a rock star about, like, where they have to turn inward? Because the world out there is just too frightening.
You know, in
their
my
fans
room,
are crazy.
Starts at the beginning. I will close this out by recommending The Last Dance, which is an ESPN documentary that the first two came out last night on ESPN. I think they're going to broadcast it every Sunday. And it's a tale. There's a camera crew sent that was allowed access to the 1997/98, which is a single season, Catherine, they bridges the calendar, NBA season for the Chicago Bulls, the sixth of their sixth championship seasons with Michael Jordan. And it was a completely fraught season. And this footage has been under wraps for 22 years. Apparently only recently Michael Jordan said, yeah, okay, you can use this. It was a all kinds of stuff was breaking down on the team. The general manager wanted to break up the team. Scottie Pippen, the other great player, whatever. It is very good, very well done. And it is such a blast of escapism, particularly right now. Catherine mentioned sort of like, do you want to actually get into the whole thing, or do you want to escapism from the thing? Especially with no sports, I've been out there like trying to recently rewatched the 1979 semifinal game of the NCAA championship series. So starved am I for sporting content. And at any rate, so it is good. It's good to great. And especially the footage of actual competition. But the commercials make you want to jump out the window, even if you're like I am or in the basement, because they're all about the coronavirus. Like, no, I don't want to hear about it. I love the first responders too. I clap at 7 o'clock, but like I wish I could watch this without commercials. I'm going crazy being reminded that I live in a world where I can't see all this gorgeous stuff.
Poor Matt, you can't escape reality. Can I just point out from a kind of philosophical perspective, I too watch that, Matt, and you know, it's great to go back to that period of time when we were both significantly younger and part of our future was still ahead of us. But I dislike that documentary and the recent Hillary Clinton documentary for the reason that the subjects of that essentially have final cut over it. And it's a weird way in which Michael Jordan and Hillary Clinton and whoever else are doing these kind of elegiac documentaries that are tributes to themselves. And it kind of elides the fact that, yeah, they also get to, they're telling their story in a way that is not quite visible or evident. And I think from a documentarian point of view, this is time where we have to start calling bullshit on this kind of self-hagiography.
The same thing is in effect of the George Harrison documentary with Martin Scorsese, which his wife Olivia had final cut over. Yeah. So you have to spend...
And it suffers from so it. It suffers.
Part of it is that you have to sort of see what they have leaking in through it. But Catherine, you were saying?
I think that this is, I mean, people are doing this on the micro level too. Like the me at 20 Twitter and Instagram phenomenon is also basically people having no particularly exciting new inputs in their lives or in their personal story, have started to go mining in their own past for things to celebrate, enjoy, think about that are not coronavirus.
I mean,
right
it's
now.
Either that or sourdough, right?
I know that.
And I prefer the Instagrams or the 20 me at 20 to sourdough.
But I think me at 20 is just the same thing as these darn documentaries, right? Like it's scratching an itch there somewhere to just like look to the past and spend a minute back there when things were different. And maybe, yes, it has a little rosy colored something draped over the lamp. But
I will say that even as somebody who doesn't watch sports and doesn't really know very much about the Chicago Bulls, other than like Michael Jordan, big deal. Dennis Rodman did some stuff. kind of crazy. Like having seen,
oh God, please
having
stop talking.
Seen several of the clips getting passed around, and some of the kind of the unearthed footage that was not widely available. It's actually pretty compelling. Also, Michael Jordan really knows how to pour a gigantic whiskey.
Very good. Let's leave it there. Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned all week for our reason.com/podcast, especially the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which is a vibrant space of largely coronavirus related content these days. It's great. So thank you, and we'll catch you back next Monday. Goodbye.